I can give a special reading for you and talk about things I normally don't have a chance to talk about. I'm going to read five poems. And after those five poems, if you have any questions about them, I'll take a little break and entertain your questions. If not, I'll go on to the second part of my presentation. I've been working on a collection, trilogy of baseball poems, and I just finished the third volume. And so I'm going to read from all three. The first three poems are short poems from If God Invented Baseball, which came out in 2018. And you'll get a sense in terms of how I've been using sort of Buddhist concepts into writing about baseball. And so this first poem is entitled Seasons. Spring training again. Young players replace the old. The game is short. Baseball. Let me sit in the ballpark, cap turned backwards and praying for a rally. I need the sun and sweat to remind me how much I love the game, how each year it comes down to the last inning, the final out. And this last poem from If God Invented Baseball is actually the last poem in the collection, The Zen of Baseball. Maybe we should play baseball by the lake. The motion of water as still as a pitcher waiting for a sign. The surrounding trees standing like coaches and managers. Who wouldn't want to walk across the lake into immortality? Those are just three poems from If God Invented Baseball. You can see there that all three poems are connected in terms of seasons. And when we look at baseball, baseball is almost actually broken down into seasons. If there was no strike right now, we would be getting ready Monday for spring training. And that's when you get the beginning of baseball. And then baseball sort of peaks during the summer. You know, you have books like The Boys of Summer. And then when fall comes, you have like the Fall Classic, you have the playoffs and World Series. And so you see that if you're a baseball player, your life is affected by the seasons. If you are married to a baseball player, your life is affected by the seasons. It's where you know that you'll see your husband during the winter. You know, that's the only season that's left for you. And so what happens is that that's a way in which when I look at these poems going back, it has that sort of connection. The last poem that I read, The Zen of Baseball, sort of places me where I completed this book. Many times writers and artists are very fortunate if they're able to go off to a residency to focus on their work, have time to work. Many artists, for example, and this is whether you're a musician or a painter or a writer, pretty much, you know, you have some other job to do. You know, and so finding that time where you can really be concentrated time is a blessing. And so the opportunity for an artist to be invited into a residency like the Virginia Center for Creative Arts, or in this case, Blue Mountain Center, which is where I finished this book, If God Invented Baseball, which is upstate New York. And so as I'm writing these poems, I'm actually sitting by a lake. Okay. So what happens is that's how that lake gets into the poem, you know, where maybe we should play baseball by the lake. But it also ties in with reading, you know, where, you know, when you talk to artists and you ask, well, where did the ideas come from? Sometimes it's a mixture of ideas. And I know that when I look at this poem, I know that the books at Hartha by Herman has influenced me. You know, I remember like Govinda by the river, you know, and ferrying people back and forth. And many times what you find is that there's a sort of spiritual awakening that one finds themselves seeing or experiencing when they see the ocean, when they see a lake, when they see a river. And so what happens is that I'm very much aware that when I was writing this collection, I was drawing upon my surroundings. Okay. And so you see me saying the surrounding trees staying like coaches and managers. That's just me using my imagination to draw upon my surroundings. Now, these baseball poems that I'm reading to you, I'm using baseball as a metaphor to examine relationships, looking also at issues of race and gender. And so the second book of the trilogy is When Your Wife Has Tommy John Surgery. If you're not familiar with what Tommy John surgery is, it's actually the reconstructing of one's arm, usually by pitchers, because the arm is really not designed to throw a baseball, okay? And the Tommy John surgery was actually a pitcher by the name of Tommy John who had the reconstructive surgery, and it was successful. In fact, he became a better pitcher even after the surgery, where before, sometimes you hear a pitcher saying, okay, they blew their arm out, you know, and their career ended. But for sort of Tommy John, he sort of changed baseball, in which what happens is that it doesn't mean the end of a career. But I use Tommy John surgery, as you can see, when your wife has Tommy John surgery. Okay, and I sort of flip it. And what you see is that in the, some of these poems, it's women who see that their relationships are failing. Okay, and you ask themselves, okay, how can they repair that? Can they have Tommy John surgery? Is that going to repair that relationship? But let me read you one poem from this collection, which is entitled Lost in the Sun. And here you see me dealing with the issue of race. Lost in the Sun. Joyful Black fathers throwing their little ones into the air. Years later, a troubling blue sky blankets the world. Black fathers at funerals, no longer able to catch their sons. Black fathers no longer standing in a field of dreams. Their black boys gone, sunglasses unable to hide their grief. Let me just walk you through this poem. You know, you've seen this many times. I talk about my own family. You know, that joyful moment where a father like sort of throws his child up in the air, you know, catches him, you know. I always tell I was dropped, you know, and that's why my SAT scores were low, but that's another story. But anyway, what happened? It's a joyous occasion in terms of throwing your child up and catching your child. And so that's there. You can see that this is a political poem, okay, because it's you see, years later, a troubling blue sky blankets the world. Well, that's an obvious relationship to the blueness in our society as represented by the police and police brutality, which is an ongoing issue within the African-American community. And the poem begins, lost in the sun, play off sun, S-U-N, but lost in sun, S-O-N, okay? And it also has to do with baseball. Many baseball games are not played during the daytime, okay? Most, for money, baseball, most baseball games are in the evening, night games, you know, where families can go. Consequently, what happens is that when you have sometimes playoff games that are played, you know, like maybe in the afternoon, or they try to get a game, you know, like, you know, that might have been postponed and they got to play, or the game is being televised to the east, but the game's being played in Colorado. And so what happens many times, the stadium is designed in such a way that the sun is setting behind the stands and sometimes blinding the outfielders, okay? But because so many ball players play at night, they really don't really wear the old sunglasses like back in the 50s and 60s where you just flip the sunglasses down, you know, to block out that sun. Many times you see a guy just put the glove up and block it that way. But that's what I was looking at, is that the whole thing of how you block out the sun with sunglasses. And in this case, the end of the poem reads, "Their black boys gone, sunglasses unable to hide their grief." Okay, so I just walked you through that poem in terms of, it's a short poem, but the concepts are very interesting because it addressed the whole thing of Black fathers losing their sons. And you know, in terms of the cycles of life, and this is me talking about seasons again, it is very, very painful for a parent to bury his or her child. Okay, that's just the thing that's out of order, you know. I remember, for example, many of you probably remember, there was the terrible earthquake in China, and a lot of people in one of the towns there they lost their children. Okay. And because of China, you only had, many people had only one child. And I remember a person, one of the elders say, well, who will bury us? You know, who will bury us? And that was something that sort of haunted me, you know, when I was reading about that. You know, that's something that should never happen. And when I turn on the television and I see a mother or father crying because they lost their child, I haven't experienced that, you know. I did experience it one time here in Washington, where I happened to be out in Southeast after a young girl who was writing for, I think, the Hill Rag. She was a young reporter, and she got shot with a drive-by. And I happened to be out in Southeast with a friend of mine, and there was a little memorial taking place, and people were gathering, newspeople were gathering, and the crowd, and the mother and father was there. And somebody recognized me, like, there's Ethelbridge here. And all of a sudden, I became like a spokesperson for the city or whatever, you know. And I had never really been in a position where you have to console someone, you know, who's not your family. You know, I've been at funerals where, you know, I take care of my mother, you know, but when you have a stranger and you realize, okay, this person has just experienced this loss, and somehow just for them to hold you means that they're connected to something that they can sort of like, okay, I catch my breath, you know, and I can continue. Okay. And that was something that I never forgot that, you know, in terms of that experience of loss. But that's how this poem sort of works in terms of I draw upon incidents that I experienced, things I've seen on TV, and try to document the times that we're coming through. And then because I'm a literary activist and not just concerned about my own work, when I go back and look at, I'll talk about Sterling Brown, the great Sterling Brown, who was first poet laureate of DC. And Sterling Brown, poetry, you know, in the 30s and 40s, if you just study his work, is dealing with issues of police brutality. You know, I mean, it was just amazing that, I mean, the, you know, not just one poem, but several poems that deal with this theme. And so when I look at me writing these poems today, you know, following this tradition, even though I may be writing about baseball, it's still say, okay, this is a theme. How can I weave it into my voice, my work today? Okay, because it hasn't gone away. In this case, I use baseball, you know, Lost in the Sun, to sort of answer that problem. Let me just read you one last poem. And this is a poem, this poem here is from the book that's coming out, you know, this fall, which is entitled, How I Found Love Behind the Catcher's Mask, and that'll come out in September. But one of the early poems in that collection is entitled, Every Buddhist is a Baseball Player. And it's in seven parts. You're a Buddhist, so you've got to figure out, is there some sort of symbolism behind seven? so we can have that discussion. One, the bullpen is quiet when it laughs at the scoreboard and rubs its belly. Two, the rally over, you're the third out, your bat asleep on your shoulder. Three, falling from the sky, the ball, a small moon falling like an eclipse into a glove. Four, the designated hitter sits in the dugout, practicing sitting meditation. Five, dirt on a jersey, a symbol of devotion to the game. Six, every Buddhist, a baseball player, each breath, a pitch, a catch, a hit. Seven, the road from the minors to the majors is the path of two directions. And that's the poem, Every Buddhist is a Baseball Player. Now, the first part The bullpen is quiet when it laughs at the scoreboard and rubs it. Yeah, you know, the laughing Buddha, you know, with the belly. So that's the image I had that from. You know, when a poet writes, sometimes he or she is sort of, they stop, say, oh, I like that line. I like that. And what I like is the last section of this poem, the seventh part, where the road from the minors to the majors is the path of two directions. You know, you're going up, down. You know, it's amazing now, especially if you're coming through like COVID, where you have to have players who might just be up for like a week or two. I don't know what type of effect that has on people's family, you know, or you're just living out of a suitcase. But this whole thing of going back and forth, you know, I think is what I like, this path of two directions. So those are just five poems that I shared from, you know, this baseball trilogy. It's my sort of contribution to American literature. You know, people are fascinated by the fact that I've been, you know, writing about baseball from so many different angles. And I'll tell you how I was affected by the pandemic. There's a pandemic baseball book club, like who knew, you know? And what happens is that my friend recommended me for that club. And it's been fascinating because it introduced me to some of these, you know, well-known baseball writers who I knew, and you know, their names, their reputation. They like me because I'm the only one who's writing poetry. You know, they're writing the serious heavy books, you know, the biographies and the novels. But I'm writing poetry, and I'm really excited because this third collection, How I Find Love Behind the Catcher's Mask, Tyler Kepner, who writes for the New York Times, you know, has blurbed the book. And he says in the blurb, like, you know, if Major League Baseball decides to have a poet laureate, I should be the poet laureate. Now you can see why there's a strike, right? I'll never have that opportunity. But I'll stop right there and just take a little break. If there's questions that you have on anything I read, if there's something that you want me to expand on, I'll be more than willing to try to answer your question. Dorothy, I know you have a question. Unmute. You have to unmute.
I particularly like the sixth one from a Buddhist perspective in your third series, because it makes you think that baseball is a game where you have to collaborate with your opponent. You have to have, I mean, the pitcher has to have a batter to pitch to, or a catcher. So the three of them are indispensable to the game. And I can't think of other games where it isn't zero sum, in a sense. So I think that that is a good image for our interrelationship.
I'm glad you said that, because one of the things when I was looking at some cover design for one of the books, I was almost dealing with a trinity, you know, the pitcher, the batter, the catcher. You know, that's a very important thing to underscore. The other thing I would say about baseball, you know, I started out talking about seasons, but the thing I like about baseball, and this is where I'm sort of in opposition to what's happening in our games and in our lives, I'm against speeding it up. You know, this whole thing of speeding up the game, you know, in terms of, you know, we have to keep young people involved and this and that. You know, baseball is slow. And I like it slow, you know, and if you go to a baseball game and you see people who are still keeping the old scorecards, they're older people, they're elders, okay? The young kids, why are you speeding up the game? They come, they're just looking at the scoreboard and you know, being on the cam and stuff like that. They're not really watching the game. And so what happened, but at the same time, we're trying to speed up the game because we're sort of packaging it for consumers. But I like the fact that it's meditative. If, for example, you have a young, you know, child or grandchild, and you take that child to a stadium for the first time, that sort of like, whoa, when they see the outfield, when they see the just the grass, when they take in the smell of hot dogs or whatever, you know, well, vegetarian wraps now. When you get all that in, you know, what happens, it's a very spiritual awakening, like, whoa, this is, you know, I'm young, you know, and what happens is the game is young, and it doesn't age, you see? I mean, baseball, you know, if you go out there, that's a way of holding on to your youth. If you're 85 and you know everybody that played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, yeah, right. Why do you want to speed that up? You see? And this is where, you know, sports is very important. If you look at the baseball strike right now, and some of it's very complicated, but one of the things that they're arguing about, and the owners are pushing this, is to make it where baseball players on their uniform hats and stuff are billboards. That's one of the things that comes in there. Somebody wants to put, you know, some sort of beer or PNC Bank on the uniform. Okay. And some of the ideas of that came from the NBA. When players started having all the tattoos, and somebody said, wow, if the player's going to have these tattoos, right, why can't I just have that tattoo be a product? You know, this is long past Michael Jordan trying to cover up himself at the Olympics, you know, because he didn't want to see it's the corporate logo. But what happens now, this is where you see, if you follow baseball, you will find that the whole corporate commercial thing is entering our lives this way. And this is why when you talk about sports and you look at it in terms, okay, what is the American pastime? How does it reflect us at this particular time? I think it's very, very important and what the lessons that we can learn. And I always tell people there's so much to learn from sports, whether it's football or basketball. You just saw, for example, Harry Edwards, a sociologist, who really emerged after the 1968 Olympics protest and then became a consultant to like the San Francisco 49ers. He said something in regards to this recent case that Brian Flores, who was fired in the NFL for the Miami Dolphins, he said something that was really amazing. He said, we're almost at a point where we have more Black people under the Supreme Court than we have head coaches in the NFL. And you just stop and say, this is 2022. And you mean to tell me that there are going to be maybe more Black people, well, Clarence Thomas and whoever, that's two, and all these years, it's just one. And so for me to be writing about baseball, it's not just to be writing about baseball, as I said, about these relationships, it's about, you know, how our lives are going through. And many of my poems in my baseball books are written from the perspective of women. Okay, because I started writing in the late 60s, but I came of age in the 70s when women's literature was really taking off. Okay, you take 1970s, you get like the beginning of Ms. Magazine and Essence Magazine. And then, you know, for me, my friends and buddies were like Alice Walker and June Jordan and Ntozake Shange. So what happened, that whole sense of what it means to be a woman in our society, you know, I'm affected by that. So the use of persona or mask to look at yourself in terms of from the other person. And I think that's a very Buddhist concept too. You know, using, if you have workshops, okay, use a persona, okay? How do I step outside of myself, outside of my race, outside of my class? Those are the challenges, okay? I mean, I'm not an expert baseball player, you know, and then I definitely don't go from a baseball, but I come from a basketball, gymnastic, you know, every other thing but baseball. You know, one Father's Day, my kids, you know, took me to a baseball game and they suffered through four innings in the heat. You know, Father's Day is like in June, right? And what happened? Oh, we'll take Dad to a baseball game because he loves baseball. We don't. And I looked at my kids, you know, and by the fourth inning, let's go. You know, they were sticking this to the back of the seat, you know, their shirts were wet because it was a hot day. But what happens is I realized that, you know, sports is so important to the family and it helps you understand, you know, those your surroundings. And so, you know, I just shared a few poems. Any other questions you have? I call on Dorothy. I can call on Miho. See what happens is that they have little names here.
Go ahead, Alex. I think Alex has a...
I really liked what the theme of things recurring in the poems, like spring training again. I think right. The second one also had each year it comes down to. And I really liked that that sense, because that's a peculiar kind of, it's like a unique feeling of I've been here before, but it's new and exciting again. And am I going to kind of take away the thing that I need to take away from it? And right. That was really beautiful and hard to capture. And so I thought that was really cool. And Yeah, and it seems like baseball is just a great way to convey that because it's so familiar.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, so
when
you say that, you know, when I'm in my 70s now, so I always talk about baseball, like, you know, it's just a seventh inning. And that's when you get at that seventh inning stretch and you get up and you sing, take me out to the ball game. And, you know, you don't even care who's winning the game. You just feel good. And it's celebratory. And I tell people when you get to your 70s, you know, that should be your era where you celebrate. You know, so I know it's, again, using that as a sort of metaphor for, like, you know, and I use the fifth inning for midlife crisis. You know, I had a book that was called The Fifth Inning. And I used that term for midlife crisis. Sounds a little better. If not, what I'll do, another question? If not, I'll continue.
Often what we do is people just put their hands in gusho if they're ready to ask a question. And
okay.
We ask them to unmute. Somebody who hasn't asked a question yet or has had a comment. Does anybody like to jump in at this point? No? Okay. How about if you continue then?
Okay. You know, I think I sent you guys, through Naomi Ayala, I sent you a link to an interview I did with Charles Johnson. And that was published in the 25th anniversary of Tricycle Magazine in 2016. And if you're not familiar with Charles Johnson, I guess, would be considered a major African-American Buddhist. He lives in Seattle and writes quite regularly for Tricycle Magazine. So you might've seen some of his work there. One book that you might want to, this is Turning the Wheel by Charles Johnson. And I just want to read you something that he says in the preface here in Turning the Wheel. He writes, "For me, Buddhism has always been a refuge as it was intended to be, a place to continue to refresh my spirit, stay centered and at peace, which enabled me to work joyfully and without attachment, even in the midst of turmoil swirling around me on all sides through good times and bad." And I think that's just a very nice sentence, you know. Buddha has always been a refuge, you know, like a home, a place. And then the whole thing of refreshing the spirit, because many times what we need to do is refresh our spirit. If we're a computer, we want to reboot, but that's another terminology. Refresh sounds much better. And then it's also saying that, you know, to work joyfully without attachment, even in the midst of turmoil. You know, many of us don't work joyfully. I remember, you know, there's two books I remember. One was Working by Studs Terkel. That was a long book, long time ago. And then my friend, Harry Maurer, he was assistant editor for The Nation magazine. Harry Maurer did a book called Not Working, right? Not Working. And he interviewed all these different professions and nobody liked their jobs, you know, except maybe two people. You know, you think that, wow, you know, I like to be a baseball player. I like to be this and that. Nobody really liked their job, you know. In fact, he interviewed like one person was like a newspaper boy, right? And, you know, he got that little paper route and he made sure that everybody got their little paper right in front of the newspaper, right in front of the door. He laid it out nicely. After a while, he was just flinging newspapers. So, you know, he's just flinging newspapers after a while. And the only two people out of this book, Not Working by Harry Maurer, there was two people. One was a fireman who felt that his life had meaning because, you know, he had the ability to maybe one day save somebody's life. And the other was a person who was like an administrative secretary. She felt that she was in charge, you know. And so what happened, she enjoyed her work, you know, a sense of identity, importance and stuff. But every other profession that you could think about, which looked attractive, you know, was really, really bad, you know? And I really look at it inside angle of women. You know, coming through the 1950s, what were the professions? Nurse, teacher, and airline stewardess, you know? I mean, those were the professions. Now, my sister, bless her little heart, she died a few years ago. My sister being pushed by my mother, who was a seamstress, oh, great, you'll be a nurse. Good job, good job. My sister hated it. you know, during the AIDS epidemic. Oh no, don't touch me, don't touch me. I said, but Marie, you are a nurse. Hold on. She's a nurse, and she's a nurse working in the, like, the emergency room. Like, yeah. Marie, what are you talking about? People bleed when they come into the emergency room. But she had no consciousness. And when it came to her job, she hated it, okay? And my brother, and this is me just filling these things in, my brother in the early 60s went off to the monastery. Okay, that one, he was one of the people influenced by Thomas Merton. And we're talking about early 1960s, you know, where to make the monks bread up St. New York, Genesis. And I think when my brother came, I think they still remember my brother, because he was like the only Black person up there. And they put my brother to work, my brother chopping trees and stuff like that, you know. But what happened is my mother couldn't accept him being away. You know, he was the oldest, and my father had like part-time work. And so my mother kept writing to my brother, and he came out of the monastery, gave up his dreams. And what happened, he was stuck in a bank. And my mother would say, oh, he's got a good job, you know, good, you know. And it was, and that was a time when it was paying really well. And then he got into computer programming and all that. So he was making a lot of money. He hated it every single day. And you see me talking to you today, I am a writer because my brother said, if you want to do anything, you have dreams, get as far away from my mother as possible. I will give you money for the Amtrak. If you want to fly to DC, I will pay for the American Airlines too. He said, yeah, you know, because he saw it, you know. And you know, parents, you know, want the best for their kids, but it was very difficult for, you know, them to say, okay, you may want to be a dancer or this, but at one time for women, those are the security teacher. Airline stewards, oh, you see the world. Yeah, right. You know, it's like joining the military and seeing the world. But what happens, that was those are the choices. And it is really sad if, for example, you're in a family and you want to pursue the arts, you want to be a dancer or a singer or a composer, and your parents who love you say, well, how are you going to make a living? Okay, and that becomes a thing of concern. But I say that in terms of, you know, what Charles is saying in this preface to Turning the Wheel, that enjoying the work, okay, enjoying the work, and then also in these times of turmoil. So that is, now what I did with Charles is back in 2011, I interviewed Charles Johnson every day for an entire year. And this resulted in this book, The Words and Wisdom of Charles Johnson. If you look at that tricycle interview that I sent, you see this picture of Charles Johnson there with his grandson. And on his desk, if you look closely at that picture, on his desk is a copy of this, you know, this book. If you ask Charles anything, like you're going to interview him like next week, he's going to go to this book and say, oh, I answered that question, and just give you something that is from page 54, whatever. But someone was always amazed that, you know, I could conceptualize this. And I did it with Charles, and it was one of the gifts I have. I can come up with questions immediately like that from interviewing people. And I just, it was a question of asking him, asked him a question. And Charles is like a boot. He was very, very exact. You know, we were posting these things online, and if there was one grammatical error, I had to go back and change the whole thing. Okay. And working with him taught me a whole thing of perfection, detail, you know. And then what happens, Charles and I have different sense of humor. He's like, just grow up. You can't do, yeah. I found it funny, Charles. You know, he gets to know. And you know, with text back and forth, humor is totally lost. Okay. But I did work on this, and out of this came this book, and then this other book also, he was able, The Way of the Writer. Reflections on the art and craft of storytelling. What happened is that a person got a hold of this book and found it to be very helpful in terms of the things that Charles Johnson was inviting people, not on Buddhism, but on about the craft of writing. So when Charles told me that, I said, Charles, there's another book within this. And in 15, 20 minutes, I took up all the entries that's in this book that deal with the craft of writing. And I said, just put these together. We got another book. Just run it past your agent. And his agent said, yes, this is good. And then he just added a few more chapters onto it, but it was a book within a book. I like those type of projects because it's a thing where I'm learning a lot from another writer. I'm studying another writer, you know, and that sort of mind-to-mind connection is extremely important. What also happened in the tricycle interview, I asked Charles in this sense, 6 questions. Okay, so you can see I'm interviewing every question every day, but I pulled out questions that I felt would be good for Tricycle Magazine. And so when you look at that interview, which I think I sent you the link to, it's just 6 questions. But if I going back and looking at it again, I feel that the two most important questions, and this might be something that you might want to discuss, you know, among yourselves at a meeting. The one is, how important is it to have a teacher when learning about Buddhism? Is the race of the teacher ever a factor? Okay, I think that is a very, very important question. You know, sometimes what happens, people find a community. I'll give you an example. You're a Black person, like myself, and you're out like, Wyoming, right? You're out of Wyoming, right? You're that guy. And I remember this. I'm out in Wyoming. I remember it was Casper, Wyoming, right? And my friends, we stop at a light, right? And I see a Black guy. Well, of course, I wave at him. He waved at me. And my friend said, do you know him? I said, I do now. But what happened, you know, you sometime are out somewhere and you talk to Black people, they'll tell you this. There's somewhere like a small town or whatever, and they're looking for a place to eat or something like that. They look in the window first to see if there's other Black people they're eating. Okay, you know, like, okay, like, you know, like a litmus test or something like that. Oh, if I see other, I'm okay, okay? Because what happens sometimes, you're in one of these small towns, you walk in, all the heads turn and look at you, okay? And what happens is that there's a sense of like, okay, are you disturbing the norm, okay? And this is a thing where, you know, back in the 50s, 40s and 50s, if you were Black driving, you couldn't go. You know, they say, okay, well, you can't come in here. You can go around the back and we'll wrap something up for you, okay? But still that type of thinking is one. So what happens, you have people who are Black people who might be Buddhist and say, okay, well, where's the local Buddhist community? And they'll go there and say, well, there were no Black people there. Were they Buddhists? Oh yeah, they were Buddhists there, but there were no Black people. Well, maybe you got the, with the B capitalized or lowercase? You know, but you know, and what happens is that that's a thing where all of a sudden it's preventing a sense of community. And then you have to ask yourself, if you are still dealing with these issues of race, okay, then what's happened with your spiritual development? Okay, then at the same time, it gets into teaching. Okay, sometimes what happens, people can reach a sense of enlightenment, but can't teach. Okay, or what happens, their mannerism. They're saying one thing in their mind, but their behavior is saying something else. And so what happens, a person coming into a community may not be welcomed by the person who's the teacher, okay? And it just might be something, you know? And I've seen this in terms of my own development. I had my kids in a private school here when they were small. I remember me and my wife went to orientation, you know, parent thing. And one of the kids came in while the teacher was talking to us. And the young kid wanted something. And the teacher said something, oh yeah, here, go get it, you know. And me and my wife, we just looked at that. And when we talked to Ms. Harris, the principal, she said, well, John went to Harvard. Like that was going to say something. Like he went to, yeah, I still think he has a problem in terms of relating to young people, because that becomes acceptable behavior, okay? In terms of something being thrown to you as opposed to actually presented to you, you see? The same way you go to some of these schools I saw in DC where, it's like the Montessori school, you just kick your shoes off. You know you're in a Montessori school because like you can't tell the kids whatever it's going. But that's the thing where if your kids go to Montessori, boy, they will be accelerated, but you're going to have some problem. They reach adolescence. Don't tell me what to do because they're going to be very independent. And what happens is as a teacher, you know, for especially for kids from Montessori, you better have good teachers to guide them through the next middle school, you see? You know, because, you know, when they come out of the things, it has a lot to do with those teachers. But that's a thing where you are looking at a school, just the behavior. The teacher could be great degrees and stuff like that, but how do they behave? So if somebody is inviting you into a spiritual community, okay, and just something in the action, you just, I don't feel right. I don't feel a sense of home. And let me show you how you can test it. Home. What happens is that many of us interact with people of other nationalities at work or someplace out, never have a sense of being invited into people's homes where there's this actual community and the breaking of bread, okay? It's almost like saying, okay, I can work with people, I can do this, but when I close the door, I want to be as far away from people who don't look like me, you see? And that's why even in 2022, when you look at our society is still very segregated when it comes to housing. Okay, housing, you know, the workplace might be integrated, okay, but housing is still pretty much very segregated, okay, and that's just something to think about. Let me, the other question that I thought in terms of looking back at that interview with Charles is the one in question where I asked, is certain parts of the world, even Buddhists have turned to violence. Why is this? How can Buddhists sleep at night after harming another human being? And this, I think the concept of ahimsa, you know, not injuring anyone, is a very important, because when we look around the world, you know, Myanmar, and India, and places like that, we see people behaving, I call like bad little Buddhists behaving badly, you know, because what happens is that, you know, it's violent, you know. Thailand, you know, there's many places like that where it's not protest. It's what I consider to be really the major issue. And I'll just say this is my view. I do not believe the major challenge facing us is race. I think the major challenge facing us is religion. You know, I when I look around, I just see this religion, you know, being very, very, very issue. You know, if I'm Jewish, okay, and I see all these swastikas popping up, you know, I'm like saying, okay, something's happening here. You know, if you look at, and this was just reported, look at the families that were destroyed by Stephen Miller and his Muslim ban. I always say Stephen Miller because that's the person, you know, behind a lot of this stuff. Family just ruined, okay? And you know that was based on people thinking that this is a Christian country, okay? That when you see, that's what we're dealing with right now, okay? And what you see is that if you are in West Africa, and you're dealing with Boko Haram, you know, it's basically breaking down into Islam and Christianity, okay? I mean, and that's a very hard situation to resolve, you know? And then you've got people who are say, you know, just secular in their beliefs and how are they protected? And when you look at our society, forget about the 1619 Project for a minute, you know, our country is built around issues of people wanting religious freedom. Okay, the ability to worship however they want to worship. That is very, very important in terms of, this is before we have a civil war. You know, people here to worship. And if, for example, we feel that this is, quote, a Christian country, and however that's going to be defined, we're going to have problems moving ahead. Okay, and you can see right now with the Supreme Court, it's very much, you know, a certain type of religion, you know, evangelical, you know, and all of a sudden you can see the type of laws that will be passed, affecting all of us, whether it's the separation of church and state, you know, which is very important. But these are issues that almost to a point when we deal with the structure might be more important than race, okay? And that's sad to look at. One final thing that I'll mention, another person who influenced me in my work is a poet and translator, Don Mi Che, who sometimes looks like Choi, C-H-O-I, but it's Che. She, like Charles Johnson, Don Mi resides in Seattle, and she was awarded a MacArthur Prize last year. She got a MacArthur last year. In 2001, though, we collaborated on a small limited edition book. This is a little book here. By Red Dragon Press, which is a press in Norfolk, Minnesota. And the title of this book was Buddha Weeping in Winter. Let me just read you the introduction to this book and the last poem, and then we can, I'll end my comment. This is sort of a little book, Buddha Weeping in Winter, and this is what Don Mee wrote back in September 3rd, 2000. It was the winter of 1997 when Ethelbert first came to my basement apartment in Seattle. He talked to me about his brother's and father's lives. He spoke of his journeys to Central America, Africa, and the Middle East while folding a paper napkin I had placed in front of him. He would also bring his hands together, half folded like a lotus flower, and speak of a bowl. He often let his chin fall into his hands, then withdraw into silence. These silent moments spoke to me of the pain in his heart and his deep longing for a bowl. I continued to serve him tea, mint tea, green tea, cinnamon, black tea. I knew if he kept drinking tea, he would find the bowl somewhere in his heart. A bowl is hollow without tea, and tea is homeless without a bowl. Holding tea in our bowls, his Buddha and mine met in winter, in silence and understanding. Ethelbert is my best friend. His Buddha poems are as impermanent as snow. When touched, they melt into rain. He refers to a lake in front of my place as the river. He tells me there's a moving despite its stillness. Despite fallen leaves and petals, Ethelbert's prayers touch the clouds. His Buddha sweeps letters and footprints. He weeps for the snow, the endless journeys of our hearts. His stillness invokes our rivers to flow, to merge with our silence, our Buddha. And the last poem in this book is Buddha Weeping in Winter. Snow falling on prayers, covering the path made by your footprints. I wait for spring and the return of love. How endless is this whiteness, like letters without envelopes. So that's my presentation, just a few things I wanted to share with you today.
Thank you so much. What a gift your presence and teaching has been for us. I hope you'll consider perhaps returning some time again.
Oh, sure. You know, I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any final questions or anything? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
A lot of gratitude. Thank you very much for offering us that. I in particular want to thank you for presenting this notion of the pitcher, the batter, and the catcher. That's going to stay with me. I can't, in our practice, we always go to the number three. And I first went to the giver, the receiver, and the gift. And the catcher is receiving the gift at the end of that play. And I wonder, returning to your poems about baseball, whether there's an element of having to let go of the sense of community and the game itself because of the element of greed that is permeating the game itself. And so there's no need for you to answer that.
But there's one thing I would say, and I find unique about baseball. Baseball is the game that I always tell people begins and ends at home. That's very interesting that it takes place like that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, enjoy the rest of your afternoon, okay?
Thank you. Thanks so
much. Take care.
Thank you.
Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Thanks.
All right.